This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3128 for Wednesday, the 29th of July 2020. Today's show is entitled Linux in Laws Season 1 Episode 11 The Python Bumper Part 2 and is part of the series Linux in Laws. It is hosted by Monochromec and is about 68 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is the chaps continue to shed more light on our beloved programming language.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by Archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Is Linux in Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insisted on this disclaimer. Happy Mum! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35 or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusted guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs. This is Linux in Laws, Season 1, Episode 11. The Python Bumper Part 2. Good morning, Martin. How are things?
Good morning, Chris. I'm good. How are you?
Can't complain. What's the point anyway?
It's not a very good use of energy, indeed. But some countries make a national sport about this.
The Dutch would be one of them? No, the English. My mistake.
Yes, indeed.
The tea is too warm, the weather is too hot, the beer is too cold, the beer is not warm enough, that sort of thing, exactly.
Indeed.
Before we get started with the second part of our bumper episode about Python, let's talk about news. I understand that you lost some money recently?
Not personally, you know, the timing is perfect. Yes, so today's episode is a little bit about hacking. One being Hacker Public Radio, which has clearly been hacked because one of our episodes mentioned something about two OAPs episode, and I'm not entirely sure who put this in.
That was me, actually.
I'm sure it must have been.
Because we are old, there's no point in denying this, Martin. There's no point in even living in denial.
Well, I'm not sure about you, but I'm certainly not drawing a pension. So
you are over 50, right? So that's close to pension year's age, no?
You're planning to retire soon on your magnificent share options.
I can't really talk about this in public. I could if it was just for the share options anyway.
Yes. This brings me on to the second point of the news. You are obviously already retired on the back of your $1.9 billion you managed to siphon off.
If anybody's listening, this is known in the trade as a false accusation.
Well, you have to obviously pretend this is...
Martin, I'm not in jail.
They would be onto you pretty, this is not, pretty quick.
I'm not doing this recording in jail. I'm still a free man, so...
Well, so dear listeners, if in future our dear colleague is not no longer turning up for the recordings, we know why, that he has been found out.
Martin, if I would be having 1.9 billion under my belt right now, I wouldn't be talking to you, rest assured.
I don't think it would fit personally, but also, yeah, did you not recently visit the Philippines?
No, I didn't. But maybe, Martin, you care to elaborate what this is all about before our listeners get even confused more.
Oh, I'm sure our listeners have. Yeah, so, I mean, this is yet another surprising episode in German company failures. Obviously, there was the famous German automakers debacle.
Martin is getting confused, but that's okay.
Yeah, I'm sure we all remember Volkswagen. So the current news is our friends at Wirecard, a German tech company, which has somehow misplaced 1.9 billion of euros.
If they even had it to start with, because that's unclear. You might be just looking at bookkeeping big scale, big time.
So, yeah, I mean, this is a good answer. Good answer, yeah.
And no, Martin, I'm not in possession of that money. In case you're still wondering.
Okay. We believe you, I'm sure, yes. All right.
No, it's a bit sad because there's a bigger picture involved. Yeah. What do you know about BaFin, Martin, in this context?
About who? How much? The BaFin?
No, the BaFin. Bundesaufsicht für Finanzdienstleistungen or something like this.
Ah,
or national regulator, comparable to the FSA.
It sounds like a general German government body of some sort.
Yeah, they're part of the Federal Ministry of Economics or something. No, it's essentially, okay. I think in the UK you know them as the FSA, the Financial Security Agency or something like this. Essentially, it's the national regulator. Mm-hmm. And for want of a better expression, this podcast is explicit. They fucked up big time too. Because about, what, half a year ago, something like this, as in last year or the year before, don't quote me, they actually prohibited shortening Wirecard stock.
Nice.
And of course, they should have been on top of this, but then they weren't. So our beloved federal minister for finance or even for economics, Altmaier, I don't remember his exact title, is already calling for a BaFin reform, meaning the whole thing didn't go down too well for the BaFin itself.
Okay, I mean, there's also the question of these, you know, the auditors to be raised.
Ernst & Young, KPMG, yes. Already law firms are gearing up with regards to potential compensation claims because Wirecard just went into receivership as of, I think, Tuesday this week. There's nothing much to be gained from that company anymore because if you are in receivership, and this is, I reckon, the same in the UK, your assets are pretty much frozen. Nobody really can get a hold of apart from maybe employees, with regards to still getting paid or something. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But being a stockholder, you are at the very bottom of that list, meaning these law firms are now taking a very serious look at the auditors to see if they can be what's the word I'm looking for?
Held accountable.
I was going for for a much more explicit description. Dragged in front of a court screaming. That's exactly what I was looking for.
Yeah, good. It sounds like they need to, right? It's, you don't lose that amount of money overnight.
Yeah, I think Ernst & Young is the main auditor here who kind of really apparently screwed up, if news coverage is anything to go by.
Indeed. So, yes, not entirely an open source related news, but it just sort of... it stood out for me reminded me of the Volkswagen one, and I'm thinking, what's going on there in Germany? What is Chris doing all this with his spare time?
Apparently, Martin has lost an awful lot of money that he previously had in Wirecard stock. My consolation, Martin, but don't worry. There's still the silver lining on the horizon. Just go for these law firms, say you are a stockholder, and then basically let's sort you out, maybe.
Indeed.
Anyway, okay, my piece of news, yes. A certain Linus Torvald has said that... Yes. The one with the Linux thingy there. Said that the upcoming version 5.8 would be the biggest ever, right?
Until 5.9, surely. But hey, yes. Did we not cover this last
Maybe
time?
Maybe we did. So in that case, we have to cut it out.
I'm sure we covered Linux and 5.8. But, hey.
But we could throw in a teaser, actually, for an upcoming interview with a certain Leonard Pöttering.
Ah, yes, of reverse glass painting.
Exactly. People, you heard it here first. Leonard has, I wouldn't say exactly confirmed, but hopefully promised to make an appearance on this show. Probably penciled in for August-September timeframe. Unfortunately, because of Martin's previous ranting about Pulse, he explicitly said, we cannot talk about Avahi, we cannot talk about Pulse, we cannot talk about System D. So, Martin, you cannot mention Dev1, your beloved distro that you're using left, right, and center. We cannot do this. So,
no, we can mention.
So
it,
it's
a short interview in that
it's
case.
It's strictly about Buddhism. It's strictly about reverse glass painting and calligraphy. This is what we agreed on, right? No open source stuff.
I'm sure our listeners will look forward to that.
Especially no controversial things like System D, right? That's the important bit. So, people, if you ever wanted to hear Leonard Pöttering's views on reverse glass painting, that's the episode to check out. More later. Let's leave it at that.
Buddhism as well. Yes. Yep.
And yeah. Let's cut over, rather, now to the second part of our bump episode on Python. The following contains the second part of the two-part Python miniseries. As listeners who checked out the previous episode may recall, our two chaps were discussing the different concurrency models offered by Python and how they are mapped onto operating system kernel and userland mechanisms. In case this doesn't ring a bell, please go back to Season 1, Episode 10 for the details. Okay, I hope that explains the significant difference performance-wise between mere userland abstractions like coroutines and the more heavy stuff. Sorry, the heavier stuff, rather, to use correct English, when it comes down to multiprocessing, multi-threading. Of course, you all have these abstractions as part of the standard library that Python offers. There's something called the multiprocessing module that contains these abstractions. While we're on the subject of stackless, there's also a very important an interesting development, let's put it this way. The language community, and this is penciled in for Python 3.10, is actively thinking about something called sub-interpreters. Before I go into the details, let me take a step back here. What do you know about the GIL, Martin? The Global Interpreter Loop.
Global Interpreter Loop. Yeah. So, I mean, this is obviously similar to any locking mechanism if you have concurrent, in this case, threads. As you explained, accessing the same address space, someone has to have a view of who is currently dealing with it.
Yes. The Global Interpreter Lock is what it says on the tin. Essentially, it's a lock inside CPython that controls concurrent access to various bits and pieces inside the language runtime. And the idea is with sub-interpreters to essentially have more than one interpreter, and I think, if I'm not completely mistaken, with separate GILs running inside one or separate or different processes, more often than not, of course, for performance reasons, inside the same address space. Meaning you have something very similar to async IO, without the expense of having to do a context switch if when you wanted to switch to a different address space. I think it's penciled in, as I said, for Python 3.10. It would be interesting to see how this develops in terms of giving a chunk of Python code their own interpreter with their own GIL in terms of increased concurrency on a CPython level. And needless to say, similar to coroutines and other approaches, and stackless, of course, the idea is not to bother the kernel with context switches, but rather keep it efficient on a user-led level, i.e. it remains in CPython, and thus doesn't, and the kernel doesn't get involved with regards to expensive operations.
Okay, so I mean, it's all interesting stuff. I mean, it's for me, I've been quite far removed from the OS for a long time since back in the day when I studied at university.
This is the trouble when you involve yourself just too much with database administration, Martin. I think. You leave.
I mean, databases have concurrency unlocks as well. So
yes.
Similar concept, but yeah.
But they're boring.
Yeah, I know. I can see the. I used to think operating systems were boring, but there's I have a new view,
Martin,
view on it again.
Martin, you have no idea.
Indeed.
Okay.
Where were we?
Can I help you with any other Python-related questions now?
Yeah, you lost my train of thought. Okay, let's go back to what we're doing. It'll come back to me at some point. Right, so, so we talked about why people use Python, what's it good for, a bit about the compiler side and stackless and the multi-processing parts of it. So you mentioned Python 3.10, Python 3.9, why, for example...
Oh, wait. Martin, hang on. The focus group... Sorry, Mark.
Focus group.
Marketing just sent a mail. The focus group is missing from this discussion. What does it say here in the mail? Compiler type checking. Yes.
Yes. Yes, okay.
Do you have any idea why the focus group came up with this? Because they have a point there.
Well,
apart from that, marketing, as usual, did a proper job here.
Well, no, I mean, this is because developers are useless. Which is why we have compilers to check their mistakes.
People, we're going to cut this out, I hope. Because insulting listeners on podcasts, especially open source ones, is not really on Martin.
You think we have a developer amongst our five listeners?
I think we have more than five listeners, maybe six. I don't know. I know it's pushing it, but certainly a fair share of them would be developers. Yes.
Okay. Fair enough.
Okay. Martin, what are the advantages of strongly typed programming languages coming from a SQL background, I might add?
From a SQL background?
Yes.
Well, I mean, databases have types, right?
Indeed, I mean, the main thing
And the advantage of any typing system is that you allocate the minimum amount of space for whatever it is you're trying to store.
Yes, so far so good.
That's one. The second is obviously you are able to execute the appropriate functions with it, or if that's the right terminology. Basically, you don't want to do any arithmetic on strings and that way around, right? So it's basically preventing errors in code by checking it at compile time rather than when it is running. Basically saying, you know, if I've declared something as a string, I can't do, the square root of it, right?
Excellent.
Any more? Have I missed
anything? Yeah. I'm just wondering, does a programming language called Rust ring a bell?
Well, it's one of these there's this German guy you keep talking about.
It's one of these hipster languages strongly typed. Yes, for those few listeners who do not know Rust yet, it's a programming language that has been developed by Mozilla since 2010. It's the I'm almost tempted to say the ultimate goal or the wet dream of strongly typed languages. The idea was to develop a low-level system-oriented programming language with extremely strong typing. And in contrast to C++ and other approaches, Rust has, or one of the ultimate aims of Rust is to be able to generate extremely efficient code. And also to cut down on testing efforts. So there's actually a saying in the Rust community, if you can convince the compiler to produce code, you're almost done. Because the Rust compiler does one thing very well. It takes your code apart and puts it back together again. It goes, Rust has a couple of traits, and before I loop back to Python, let me explain a little bit to you.
Okay.
For example, Rust, for example, doesn't have garbage collection, unlike Golang and other compiled strongly typed languages. It relies on sophisticated memory concepts like ownership, borrowing, and so forth. Rustlang.org is your go-to source, people, if you want to know more about it. But one of the side effects of the strongly typed language, and with the in combination with these concepts, is that you are, being a Rust compiler, that you're able to literally do an awful lot of type checking already at compile time. So you know, for example, at any given time who owns a variable, you know the scope of the variable, and so you can do an awful lot of optimizations already at compile time and doesn't have to refer this to runtime. Like, for example, some of the just-in-time compilers do it. Java probably being the best example. So you are able to generate machine code then and there. And you're also able, because you did a thorough analysis of the, of the code, you're also able to generate very efficient machine code. And this is kind of the ultimate goal. And Python, on the other side, wasn't developed with that goal in mind, because the idea was to shift type checking, from the compilation phase, which isn't really there anyway, because essentially what CPython does, it takes a program code, parses it, constructs an abstract syntax tree, as explained before, and then executes an intermediate code generated from this AST. And only then the type checking does take place. For example, if you are defining a class in Python that has a certain fingerprint in terms of the methods you define in this class, and these methods of course have their own signatures in terms of what variables they define. These variables typically do not have a type, so you can pass whatever you want to it. So it's up to CPython at runtime to determine if the variables, for example, match the signature, or even if a particular member function is part of a class definition. It cannot do this at compile time because it doesn't have a compile time as such. It has to do this at runtime. Also, for example, if you have inheritance, it is, in contrast to other languages like Java or C++, it's only determined at runtime what particular polymorphic function is invoked. And of course, that costs time. So, the idea was at some stage to introduce a somewhat gentle typing approach. You'll see this actually in the PEPs, in the Python enhancement proposals, where people initially on the IDE front decided to introduce types in terms of tell the IDE what types they have in mind when they, for example, implement a function. The idea was, of course, to give the IDE a hint to do some sort of checking already at editing time. Meaning, if you hand over a piece of Python code to the interpreter, the chances that your program will bark at you because CPython is not able to execute the program correctly because you've made a mistake is less than before. Meaning, if you take a look at PyCharm, if you take a look at Visual Studio Code, all the plugins for Python, to some extent at least, support typing already. Meaning, if you annotate your source code, the IDE is already able to give you hints of what's working at what and what might cause problems at runtime. It goes without saying that from a language standard perspective, this typing is purely optional. It's in the PEPs.
Indeed.
Yeah, it's in the PEPs. But you don't have to do it. You can hand off the Python code to your CPython interpreter. Without typing, he'll execute it happily. But the idea is, of course, to save money and time before you even execute the program. This is the overall concept behind this.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense so far?
Yeah, that's one. No, I mean, it's I do like the small amount of time I spent on Rust as well, I have to say.
You did spend time on Rust. What did you do?
What did I do? Well, I looked at some of the links you gave me.
You copied and pasted some of the Rust by example things and wondered what they do.
I decided to read the accompanying blurb as well.
Excellent.
It's a bit
people,
more than that,
people, yeah. Not all hope is lost. We may be able to turn Martin Visser at the tender age of, okay, let's pass on this one, into a hipster programmer at the end of the day, hopefully. This is the ultimate game.
Yeah, I mean, compared to, say, Python, it doesn't have the whole modules behind it, right?
Oh, it does. It's called the Cargo ecosystem.
Yes, it's not in the same vastness, let's put it that way. Being considerably younger.
You want to double check this.
Okay.
Python has at least 4 web frameworks that come to mind immediately. Django, Flask, and the other ones are Pyramid and something else. The two I can't remember. Mm. Rust has 4 to choose from. The difference being 15 years. Mm. Rust is about 10. Python 25 plus?
Yeah.
If you take a look at the last Stack Overflow language survey, I think Rust was among the top 5 languages. There's a reason for that. The ecosystem is developing rapidly with Rust. Just take a look at crates.io. This is your go-to source, similar to the Python package index, for packages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's called Cargo, isn't it? Mm.
So chances are, similar to Python, there might be a crate with the functionality already being implemented that you're looking for in Rust.
Okay, that's fair. I haven't got that far yet, as in writing.
I think that's chapter 5 in the book.
Let's see. It's quite a long book as well. Yeah, it's very long.
Yes, program languages do have the intrinsicacies, and sometimes it does take time to learn them, yes. If so-called life doesn't help.
I don't resist.
Sorry, yes, I couldn't resist.
Thank you. Yes, very helpful. Well, this is why we have handy...
More than happy to, yes.
Tech support guys on hand. Very helpful. So what number is... popularity of programming language, right? This is... What is this driven by? This is not driven by how good the modules are or how good the type checking is, right? This is not how things work.
No, it boils down to you do a pretty clever bot implementation that basically scrapes the likes of GOB and Stack Overflow and off you go. It's rigged anyway.
Mm.
People, you didn't hear this. That was a joke. Stack Overflow's surveys are not rigged. They are real. For a reason, I might add. Stack Overflow, by the way, you're doing a pretty good job. If you're listening, full marks.
What are the ingredients for their popularity counts?
Questions answered, if I'm not completely mistaken. And they do a, and they do a survey too. Yeah. They have multiple vectors feeding into the survey. And
I think once you get so the websites where you can vote for programming language or technologies in general.
Actually, you're wrong. Rust is on top now.
See? That, of course, makes it one of the top five. Just to be correct here, Martin.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. It is, however, not in the top five of most wanted languages. Okay, fine. Interesting point. Sorry, you can cut this out. I've never actually looked at the... I mean, there's the survey part, but I don't know if there's any other part to the stack.
There's also something called the importance of being earnest, effectively known as Chiobe. That is another language index.
No,
if I care to remember, I'm going to put this into the show notes. They have more than...
No, it's a book. It's a book, not a movie.
That came earlier. No, I'm talking about the Program Language Popularity Index now. It's a Danish company. They take more than just Stack Overflow and friends into account. But similar to Stack Overflow, they do an annual survey of just programming languages.
Okay.
In contrast to Stack Overflow, that does a much more encompassing survey, also including database and other middleware. If I'm not completely mistaken.
Yeah, so Python was the most questioned language.
I mean, you see this all over the place. For example, there's a significant movement in the big data community of abandoning R, which has been the standard go-to programming language, in favor of Python.
Indeed. This is a bad idea.
Never mind MATLAB, which is, of course, proprietary.
Yeah, no, I like R. It's a great language. Especially compared to Python.
I mean, and of course...
Sorry.
that remains to be seen.
Give me R anytime.
I mean, you probably heard about this. There's this database company that does a pretty popular NoSQL in-memory database, and they have recently developed something called Gears that allows you... Redis Labs I'm talking about now for a change. And actually, you can script now one of the most popular NoSQL in-memory DB servers in Python, meaning that you can ship off your Python code to the database server, and the database server would execute this as part of a CPython standard implementation on the server itself.
I wonder who came up with that idea.
Redis Labs.
No, I think it's been done before in databases, but that's okay. Sorry.
Yeah, but you see, only with crappy languages like SQL, not with real ones. That's the difference.
Ah, I see. Oh, they go together, right?
Redis Labs, if you're listening, we're opening for sponsoring slots. Do get in touch. I'm just saying. If you think that the current level of sponsoring is not good enough, get in touch.
Yes, we may mention you a bit more frequently.
We can certainly do something about this. We know our marketing people, so just reach out.
Indeed. Okay. Does that bring our Python discussion to an end? No, it doesn't. Aha.
I think we still have this.
Python 3.9.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Noteworthy.
A new parser, yes. But I think I touched upon this already. Guido isn't happy with the existing LL1 parser, so he's coming up with...
Yes, but why? Why?
Because if you take a look at the PAP, there are certain efficiencies with the current implementation.
Which are?
Limited look ahead, for example, and the ability only to parse, context... A certain level of context sensitivity, is that what I'm looking for? So the idea is basically to replace the existing LL1 parser with something called the PEG parser. I don't know what this stands for.
Parsing expression grammar.
That's the one. Thank you very much. Yielding a more efficient, hopefully parser implementation. I mean, given the fact that this hasn't really changed since, I think, Python 2, because since then Python 2 has always used an LL1 parser, that's a pretty radical change. but only under the hood, because Python will stay the same. You're just changing the parser implementation.
That's yeah, it is not really a noticeable change from a Python user perspective, or it's more a changing the engine underneath.
Correct.
Scenario. Yeah, I'm sure LL1 parses.
And yes, when I read the PEP some time ago, before I probably had too much beer, but we can cut this out. the current LL1 implementation doesn't do a pretty good job on AST generation, as in the abstract syntax tree. And Guido hopes, with the PEP, that the AST generation will then be streamlined. This is the overall idea. Needless to say, also increasing the AST generation speed. Because if you take a look at a benchmark where CPython spends its time, AST generation is a good chunk of this.
Right.
And every microsecond you can shave off here will lower the startup time. If you if you're feeding it the your usual a couple of million lines of code as part of your Python code base.
Couple of million.
The likes of Dropbox and so forth, yes.
Ah. I mean.
Like the big code bases in Python. You'll notice it also with a couple of thousand lines, but the increase won't be that visible, of course.
Sounds like a bad idea. Okay. Right. Excellent. So, yeah, sounds like it's still very much a developing alive piece of language, which is good. And
I mean, this is what the PEP process is for, right? Making improvements.
Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, you can improve anything, right? But it's whether there's motivation or need to do it. But it's good to see that there is for something like that. Okay. Anything else in 3.9 that tickled your fancy?
Not as far as I can remember. I reckon there's a multitude of improvements, but this parser thing just immediately came to mind.
Okay.
But then I only read the PEPs every second day, not every day, for breakfast, so that's okay.
What is the Rust equivalent of a PEP? Is that a rep?
It's called a... I knew it. No, it's not a rep. It's a request for a proposal, an RFP, I think, if I'm completely
RFP?
Mistaken. Yes.
That sounds okay. Oh yeah. Fair
or a request for improvement. It's on rustlang.org. There's a similar process in place.
A rip. Yeah, that sounds good.
There's a similar process in place. Check out rustlang.org. There's also, I think, a podcast tackling the improvement proposals. But the community process is pretty similar to the existing, to the now existing, I might add, community process in Python, because Rust doesn't have a BDFL, if I'm not completely mistaken. I think it's government, I think even Mozilla.
I guess it came from Mozilla, right?
Yeah. So Mozilla handed this to the community, and it's now done via mailing list and all the rest of it, as usual.
Cool. But is there some, who makes the decisions on these?
I think there's some sort of community process in place.
Okay.
Maybe there's a language committee similar to the one in Python. I do not know.
I'm just curious.
But unlike Oracle with its community process, it's a real community one, if I'm not completely mistaken. Because I think the community process for Java doesn't deserve its name, if memory serves correct.
Oh, there is such a thing.
The ultimate decision still lies with Oracle.
Yeah. Cool. All right, so final word on Python?
Use it. Simple.
Okay, I think many people do, yeah. So that's better. Okay.
Okay, is there anything else I should, our listeners, we talked about PEPs already. If you encounter anything that it doesn't make sense, feel free to go to python.org, as in, the sketch does revolve around the notion of PEPs, but we tackled this already. If there's
and the specific PEP number of
That's 572. For the benefit of the listeners, this is actually the PEP where Yidu decided he had enough of the shit and decided to return the benevolent dictator of life ownership to the community. PEP 7, and I think the sketch revolves around this 572. For the benefit of the listeners, essentially it's an amendment to the language syntax that wasn't exactly a runner, let's put it this way, with the more purist members of the community that do not necessarily wash with the community, let's put it this way.
Well, wash with the community, but there are also there is probably worth mentioning the Zen of Python.
Yes. You want
in that context.
You want to explain the Zen of Python? I think that's PEP 8, right? Or PEP 4.
I don't know the number, but there are... No, it's 20. Was there one 20? I don't know.
Perhaps, yes.
So like any good open source project, they have a set of rules, guidelines that they'd like to adhere to, and which is called the Zen of Python.
I think it's PEP 20. Yeah. You're right, yes. So you got to be concise. No shenanigans with the neighbors. Smoking isn't allowed. You have to indent with four spaces or a tab. And no curly braces.
Yeah. So that was a mistake, right? No. Actually, that's not in the... No, the tab stuff isn't in there.
The indentation certainly is.
I hope you paid note to rule number 16, maybe? Anyway, let's not discuss the Zen of Python. Anybody should read
PEP 20, it. I think. Martin Schreiber.
Even though there's only 19, but yeah. Hey.
There is? I think there's more like 800 of them these days.
No, PEP's 19.
I'm confused.
The Zen of Python contains 19 rules.
Ah, sorry, yes.
Or guidances or...
Sorry, I beg your pardon. Okay. Indeed. So you got to do Guido and I'm going to do the rest. And let's start later. Mm-hmm. So it's called Guido and the Walrus. And let me read the intro. Somewhere in a tiny house by the sea, set amongst tulips, our hero Monty is about to tuck into another piece of cheese to accompany his evening smoke and grulch.
Goedenavond.
I have a problem with your walrus.
Oh, yes, what's the problem? As far as I know, he's quite well.
A:=1 could be used as a classic assignment, and then it's hard to explain to beginners why A:=1 should rather be used as it looks the same and seems to behave the same. Whatever happened to there should be one, and preferably only one, obvious way to do it?
Aha, I see. You clearly are a bad programmer coming out with a poorly constructed and complex sentence like that. I take it you are not referring to my magnificent moustache when you are talking about walruses?
Nay.
Neither are you referring to my large flippant pet marine mammal I keep on the Nermai beach?
Nay.
Well, in that case, dear Ralph, you have failed to comprehend commandment number 14, which clearly defines the way.
14th commandment? I thought there were only 10, and I thought there were rules.
Commandment number 14. This way may not be obvious at first unless you are Dutch. Goedenavond. Ja?
I'm calling to say I'm completely in Raymond Hettinger's camp.
What?
I never knew Raymond was gay, so all the close attention on his part wasn't a token of him idolizing me?
No. I agree with him that there is a sudden rush to add new features to the language, and some things are getting in there that don't seem thought through or finished.
Ugh, another one who doesn't know the commandments. Right, check out commandment number 6, readability counts. Doei. What new year?
I really don't like this idea. It puts one of the worst parts of C into Python while making things significantly uglier.
I think you are mistaken. You can put a Python into the C, but not a C into a Python. Come to think of it, I'm not sure that Pythons can swim. And they say the Dutch are crazy. Dot scenes.
Due to severe budget restrictions related to COVID-19, we were not able to afford a sophisticated set of sound effects this sketch deserves. So for the following, please imagine a bus arrival accompanied by crowd noise.
Yeah.
Monty relights his smoke and takes a seat outside to gaze at the sweeping tulip fields, only for the silence to be rudely interrupted by a coach of Polish tourists. I need to speak to you about my strong emotional reactions to Pep 572. I feel that name := expression doesn't fit the narrative of Pep 20. It doesn't remove complexity. It only removes it, and that's a bad bargain. := also goes against having one obvious way to do it.
Come sit and have a smoke. You don't seem to understand the usability improvements this will give.
This sounds dismissive to me. I did read the PEP and followed the discussion on Python Dev.
It was meant to be dismissive. I'm tired of every core dev starting their own thread about how PEP 572 threatens readability or doesn't reach the bar for new syntax, etc. These arguments are emotional and subjective, and I haven't even mentioned you walking all over my tulips.
I personally think that multiprocessing is more performant than threading.
This is how big decisions get made. Nobody can predict the outcome with sufficient accuracy. It's like buying a new house, or a new car, or a wife. In the end, you decide with your gut, as all they have in common is four wheels, in case of a car, some windows and doors, in case of a house, and, well, I don't need to tell you about women.
I refer to PEP 20 because it distills what's unique about the value proposition of Python. It's our shared vocabulary.
It's poetry, dear boy, not a set of axioms. You can't prove anything with an appeal to PEP 20. You can appeal it for sure, but such an appeal, by definition, is subjective and emotional. There's only one way to do it. Yes, there is. My way. Now get off my land.
If now is greater than never, and never often is greater than right now, then IT equals idea dot bad end.
Blimey, you are one special case. But special cases are not special enough to break the rules. Wally, go get him.
A large walrus comes down the dune and squashes poor Lukasz, quoting commandment number 5, flat is better. Okay, who's Lukasz?
He's one of the people that wrote back about... He's actually quite an important community member, to be honest. And you may want to look him up.
And so is Raymond Hettinger, I suppose.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
No, let me... I've forgotten his name now, but he... I think he's one of the 5 now. Lukasz. Yeah. He's quite an... 5 people that govern the project.
Okay, now that we have covered the second part of the bump episode on Python, maybe it's time for the feedback. And as a matter of fact, Claudio Miranda wrote, "You really thought I wouldn't have done my research before recording? Fools!" And then something laughing. "I had already found out about the new pricing scheme from the inside source in the deep web way before my review. And given the changes and all the red tape usually involved with such things, I knew it was worth putting that information out there for humankind to behold. And since your assumption of my lineage was an extra benefit," and he says, "I'm not Italian, I can now leak this cable from the Fratellanza di Correzioni.
Fratellanza?
Yes, it was in the sketch. And the link actually will be in the show notes. And then he says, "Heck, the planet, the truth is out there. I want to believe." And then it says, "Thanks for the recursive review. Claudio. My skin is pretty thick. Regards, Claudio." Claudio, thank you very much for that feedback. Mm. Much appreciated. Now we know that we're gaining attention all the time, which is good news. Because there's no such thing as bad publicity, right?
Planet scale hacking now, aren't we?
Indeed.
So, yes, excellent.
And what does that remind you? The truth is out there, I want to believe. That's actually a quote from a famous TV series.
Yes.
But maybe you are too...
It's a sci-fi one.
Not necessarily. No. Well, to some extent, no. Yes.
Yes. Say, is it X-Files?
Yes! X-Files? Very good, Martin. There's still hope, right?
It's in there somewhere.
Yes. You see, Martin, yes, that means you are old, because that show was popular in the 80s, right?
No, it was a bit later than that.
No, 80s, I think.
Okay, fair enough. It featured Scalder and Molly, or
yes,
something?
Yes, and David, I can't even remember his second name. David Duchovny?
Something Polish.
Yeah, something.
Yes.
Of California Cation fame, right? Very important. That was actually his breakthrough before he went on to bigger things. The X-Files.
There we go. And the lady's name is?
I do not know, but she appeared in a number of B-class movies later on. I mean, that was a breakthrough too, but she, in contrast to David, she didn't make much of it. I can't even recall seeing her in a couple of adult entertainment movies.
Right.
That friends keep talking about. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Sorry, I was distracted by thinking of the name. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
I'm sure there are websites out there telling you, which are able to tell you exactly that.
This is why people don't have memories anymore, right? There's too many websites.
Indeed. Okay. That was the only feedback on that episode. And again, Claudia, thank you very much for this. Much appreciated. By the way, we love the alias. Martin checked it out. Apparently, it's a photographer being featured or a filmmaker on IMDb. And if it's not you, it looks pretty okay. The guy is, like us, a little bit old, but we just love the hairdo. Really impressive.
Yeah, it would surprise me if it was him, because, you know, filmmakers, open source, Hacker Public Radio. It would be a very odd hobby to have, but it is, stranger things have happened, right?
Indeed. Speaking of Hacker Public Radio, yes, let's give them a plug. We are still hosted on Hacker Public Radio. Ken, you're doing an excellent job. Never mind the recent email exchange. We still love you and Hacker Public Radio. And for the time being, we will remain on that platform, especially given the fact that we now have our own RSS feed, which is...
And doing daily episodes.
Not doing daily episodes, no.
No?
No, we are not.
Oh, okay.
No, Hacker Public Radio talks about
Ken
2 weeks
from us.
between the shows. Yes, and Ken, that your advice has been taken on board. We will rearrange the schedule, no worries. Okay, is there anything left to talk about? Yeah, poxes.
Yeah?
Yes. Any poxes, Mon? Apart from the one that I sent to you.
You sent me a
pox?
Which one?
I sent Martin a pox about a TV series called The Secret Diary of a Call Girl.
Ah, TV.
Yes,
TV,
yes. Have you checked out the episode?
Does it have to be TV?
No, it doesn't.
No.
That was my pox, Martin.
That was your pox?
Yes.
Oh,
okay,
for those people... Anyway, you can talk to us about it.
For those few listeners who don't know what I'm talking about 13 years ago, I think it was ITV or... Couldn't have been the BBC because it's way too...
Too...
What's the word I'm looking for?
Controversial?
No.
Entertaining?
Well, you see quite a bit of skin, let's put it this way, and that wouldn't happen with the BBC.
Explicit,
yes. Thank you, Martin.
We'll get there.
Okay, yeah.
No charge.
Yes, I mean, they are not as explicit as your ordinary porn movie, no, but it's done very tastefully. But the TV series describes the ups and downs of a London-based call girl especially her woes with relationships. And the bit on IMDb and other platforms has drama, but it's rather funny at times.
Okay.
So, Martin, if you have nothing better to do, check it out.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Yes, that has a catchy title, obviously, but I didn't get any further than that. That's just kind
of and of course, the links will be in the show. The link will be in the show notes.
Links, yes. Many links.
Do you have a pox?
Yes, I do have a pox to make up for the tech related news.
Yeah, Martin's pox would be 1.9 billion sitting in his bank account. In case anybody's wondering,
I don't think that would be a very sensible place to put it.
It depends on where that particular bank account is, Martin. Right.
I don't know, you tell me.
I wouldn't know what you're talking about.
Where are your bank accounts?
I can't really talk about these things in public, Martin.
Sensible.
Okay.
So my pox of the week is actually
1.8 billion?
No billions involved. Slightly more interesting than money. Okay, do you remember a computer called the BBC...
Micro?
Microcomputer.
Oh yeah, I do.
Yes.
That was one of the first ARM implementations on the planet.
It was. And the people who designed this?
BBC? No. Probably not.
ITV.
Man, you tell me.
No, there was a couple of people who designed this. One of them is Dr. Sophie Wilson, and I came across this great lecture on microprocessors, past and future, and where we are going. So it's about an hour and a half, no, a little bit over an hour and a half long, but it talks about the, obviously the limitations and the history. It talks about the BBC Micro ARM and where our processors going. So it is a very worthwhile. This lecture is done by the one of the co-designers of BBC Micro and ARM. So
the link will be in the show notes, people.
In show notes. Worth a watch, listen, if you want to be less entertained than The Secret Diary of a Call Girl or whatever its name
is. I reckon that presentation is slightly more technical than
yes.
TV series. But indeed, it's interesting because this is where it all started, because the BBC or whoever commissioned this computer was looking for an inexpensive microprocessor at the time, and for some reason they didn't want to go down the Rockwell route, as in 6502. There was something called 6809 already, and I reckon that was a little bit of a precursor to that ARM architecture, no?
This is quite an in-depth lecture, right? So it shows you all the microprocessors designs of those times as well, and how the kind of the ARM design is different and so on. So it's very much worth a if you're into microprocessors, but
not everybody is. To be fair, I mean RISC and ARM, of course, being probably the most used RISC architecture on the planet, given its mobile penetration alone, goes back to, funny enough, actually, a company called IBM. They used to do punch cards, and then they came around...
paper tape too.
And then they had this grand vision of that the planet only needs 5 computers, what was then known as a computer. Of course, they were slightly off with that assumption. But the rest is history. But at the around the 50s, early 60s, they designed something called they designed a machine called the mainframe, which is now known as the mainframe, as in big machines, little memory, for that time quite a lot actually, but that was actually the precursor to the virtualized multi-user multitasking computers that we now know as Linux, Unix, you name it. Because the first hypervisor was actually called VM, and that came from IBM. and that was as early as 72, if I'm not completely mistaken. Around the same time...
You're better at dates than I am.
Which is quite funny, because you are younger than me. Not much, but a little bit. Anyway, it doesn't matter. At the same, I mean, and that mainframe architecture, just to kind of briefly shed some light on this, this mainframe architecture consisted of what would be now called a CISC, a complex instruction set computer, because it had many machine instructions, it had many addressing modes and all the rest of it. And then somebody sat down and said, how can we save on this? And they ran, or he ran, a statistical analysis on COBOL compilers and assembler programs and all the rest of the typical applications that were then run on the mainframe, and came up with the conclusion that about 20% of the instructions were really used. And hence, the reduced instruction set computer was born, then known as ROMP 801. And that was the first commercial RISC implementation on the planet, and the rest are just copycats. As in the Rockwells of the world, even IBM copied that design for something called 6150. That was actually the first RT PC with a RISC architecture on a kind of PC basis coming from IBM. I think I administered the first machine in Germany at the time in 86 that was running a modified version of AIX. The Unix then being deployed on that hardware. And of course, we all know what came out of it, namely the PowerPC architecture that was used by Apple in the early Macs until they decided to go for Intel. And now they're coming around back. Yes. Because as probably most of you know by now, Apple has taken the step to something called A14, which essentially is their interpretation of an ARM architecture mostly used until now in iPads and iPhones. And there's a little bit of a juicy story, and that probably should have made it into the news, but apparently, and this is something that was leaked yesterday or the day before, we are recording this on the 26th of June, by an ex-Intel employee, that Apple was so pissed off with the quality of the Skylake line of CPUs that was in 2015, 2016, that they decided it's enough with Intel. We do our own thing. It took them about their own sweet time, as in 4 years, but now they said that come, I think, the next Mac generation, they would be based on A14s. With a lot of migration periods penciled in and dual binaries, as in FAT binaries, as we had it when they switched from PowerPC to Intel. I think, when was it? 2007 or something like this? 2006? Maybe I'm wrong. I put a link into the show notes for a Wikipedia Wikipedia page where you can read this up. But again, they have gone round full circle. Now let's see what comes next.
Funny, very, very quick question on that. Do you remember what the first IBM PC was priced at?
That was not the XT, but the precursor, and I'm guessing now $5,000 to $7,000.
Yeah, I don't remember it being that high personally, but
it wasn't cheap.
Yeah, because
for the spec.
But yes, it's for the spec. Yeah, but in comparison to your. Like your C64s or whatever, it was definitely 10 times more expensive.
I mean, IBM aimed this at your office environment,
yes,
commercial stuff, and I mean, I can recall owning a clone in 84, 85. Because I couldn't afford to buy a real IBM PC, and that clone was the same spec for about half of the price, give or take. That had an 8088 in it, 64 megabytes of RAM, 2 floppy disks. And I later bought a hard disk for this, but it was a pretty clunky machine in comparison to now. But that was the first, that was IBM...
pre-hard disk, yes, of course.
That was IBM's first foray into the microcomputer market on a 16-bit basis. And they chose Intel for this, and not some proprietary... not their proprietary architecture. Okay, people, thanks for listening, as usual. Please send feedback.
Yes,
please send feedback to feedback@linuxinlaws.martin. EU.
EU.
Yes. Thank you for listening, and speak to you soon. This could be your opportunity to sponsor one of the most popular open source podcasts on the planet. Boasting global listenership that goes well into double digits, we hope, Linux Inlaws is loved by developers, ops people, and diverse as in DevOps alike. So Redis Labs, Mongo, and Couchbase. If you want to be part of the happening crowd, simply get in touch with our sales organization at sales@linuxinlaws.eu. And no, sponsorship is not confined to NoSQL database companies. We are happy to accept donations from operating system companies, middleware geeks, compiler projects, the Yellow Press in general, and Brad Pitt and Aaliyah Shawkat in particular, as long as they are open source. This podcast is licensed under the latest version of the Creative Commons license, type attribution share alike. Credits for the intro music go to Blue Sea Roosters for their song Salute Margaret, to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow, used for the segment intros, and finally to Celestial Ground for their song Sweet Justice, used by the Dark Side. You find these and other ditties licensed under CC at Jamendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts. Okay, should we do the dialogue now?
If you like. I still have beer, so that's...
Excellent, good. Excellent. Okay, you do the Dutch part, because my Dutch is crap.
Do you want me to do the... what's his name? Add in the sounds and stuff to this one, or are you happy to do that?
No, I'm going to do the post-production, no worries.
Okay, fine.
Okay, before we go into the, dialogue/sketch, yes, there's a certain amount of Dutch involved.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not too sure if the level of Dutch competency with our listenership is good enough to understand this. I mean, Goedenavond is pretty much self-explanatory.
Okay. Good point. Let's have a think.
But I think apart from the introductory things, we should do this in English rather
than
Dutch.
There's not that many, really, is there?
I can recall at least one sentence.
Okay. All right. I can do that. That's fine. No problem. We'll go Dutch English. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. So you're gonna do Guido, and I'm gonna do the Walrus. Excellent. Okay.
Talking about walruses?
Nee. As in Dutch for no.
Sorry.
That's okay. No worries. Go on.
Okay. Well, in that case, dear Ralph, you have failed to comprehend. Right. Start again. Sorry. Cut that bit out. Commandment number 14. This way may not be obvious at first unless you are Dutch. Goedenavond.
Geen.
Ja.
Geen. We're gonna add this in later, yes, no worries. Some sound effect. Okay.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.